Copenhagen dominated the news this week, but the big story on the domestic front turned out to be healthcare.
This bill will do so many good things for so many people. Some on the right think this bill goes too far. To them, I say, you have a lack of understanding what the problems in America are today.
If they were proud of this bill, they wouldn't be doing it this way. They wouldn't be jamming it through in the middle of the night on the last weekend before Christmas. This bill is a legislative train wreck of historic proportions.
Joining us now to talk about this and other stories from the week is James Fallows, national correspondent for The Atlantic and our news analyst here on All Things Considered. Jim, have you been outside yet today?
Awkward question. I watched my wife as she shoveled the walk. I have the ideal marriage.
All right. Well, let's start with health care, Jim. A dramatic turn this morning. The Democrats got 60 votes, the votes they needed, picking up Nebraska Senator Ben Nelson's support.
Well, I think that this is something the Democrats in the Obama administration have been saying all along, that it would be close, but finally they would make the compromises on abortion, on the public option, on everything else necessary to hold their 60 votes together. I think what's worth mentioning right now, apart from all the merits of health reform, which we'll discuss for weeks and months to come, is the procedural issue. You know, we've been so used to hearing about 60 votes as being what's necessary to do anything
right
in the Senate. You know, historically, there had been the rule to cut off the Senate has unlimited debate. And so to end that, there had to be a cloture vote, which until 1975 was 67 votes, a two-thirds majority. And since then, it's been 60 votes. But until really the Clinton administration, it was done only rarely. I worked for Jimmy Carter long ago, and it was maybe 8 or 10 times per year, starting really with Bill Clinton's time in office. And ever since then, there's been the sense that to do anything, to confirm a Supreme Court appointment, to get anybody appointed, to do any sorts of bill, you'd had to have this supermajority. And it's had, I would argue, a kind of, whether you're Republican or Democrat, it has a distorting effect on the way we do business. It makes it hard to direct any public attention on things that need to be done.
Jim, going back to Copenhagen for a moment, as we just heard in David Kestenbaum's report, there had been this huge rift between China and the U.S. over the issue of verification. Is that rift now closed?
I think it is a very important rift. I think the report by from Copenhagen portrayed it accurately. This is, in a way, the perfect storm, if you will, of problems for China. On the one hand, data coming out of China are admitted even by the Chinese to be very, very suspect. For example, a pollution reading above 100 in Beijing would qualify as a polluted day. So day after day, the readings would always be 99, and all sorts of other illustrations of that sort. So to have any agreement with China, it has to be somehow testable. On the other hand, there is still, even in modern China, this almost this very partly understandable, partly primitive fear of just having foreigners go around the country. The fact that Google Earth can show things in the country that people have never known about is still very disturbing. So the way to solve this gap of being able to prove things from China without offending China's sense of security and national dignity, that is a difficult problem and will be a significant one going forward.
An interesting story, Jim, out of Iraq this past week. Insurgents apparently were able to hack into video and then intercept video from an American Predator drone using a piece of computer software that they bought off the internet for $26.
I have a bulging file in my office back when I used to keep files with paper clips of the so-called weapons of the week, sorts of countermeasures like this, certainly back in the Vietnam War with bamboo sticks and other things of the sort. The adversaries there were able to overcome America's vast high-tech arsenal. And this is the fundamental challenge for a technological power like the U.S. militarily. We have the huge advantage in information technology and weaponry, and sometimes there are very cheap ways to thwart the advantage we have. So I'm sure that coping with this asymmetrical warfare is going to be the next headache for the Pentagon.
That's James Fallows, national correspondent for The Atlantic and our news analyst here on the weekend. Jim, stay warm.
Same to you, Guy.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Guy Raz. Few here in Washington will ever forget this day, one of the snowiest December days on record, but also the day Democratic Senator Ben Nelson agreed to back his party's health care bill after 13 hours of marathon negotiations.
I intend to vote for cloture and vote for health care reform.
It's one of the final hurdles to getting a bill passed by the Senate before Christmas. And today, President Obama seemed relieved that his plan, or at least a version of it, now seems likely to become law.
After a nearly century-long struggle, we are on the cusp of making health care reform a reality in the United States of America.
In a few moments, we'll check in with former Senator Tom Daschle, who played a pivotal behind-the-scenes role in gathering those 60 votes needed to pass a health care bill. But first, to NPR's David Wellna, who's covering the story for us on Capitol Hill. David, what did it take to win over Senator Ben Nelson, the last holdout in the Democratic caucus?
Well, Guy, more than anything, it took a change in the health care bill's language regarding abortion coverage, which would be provided to people getting federal subsidies for buying insurance. He said he was satisfied with the new language in the bill that walls off any taxpayer funding for abortion. But it didn't hurt as well that Nebraska got a pretty sweet deal, unlike other states that lose extra federal funds after 3 years to help pay for expanded Medicaid coverage. Nebraska now gets that federal aid indefinitely.
So beyond that deal, what else did Harry Reid, the majority leader, have to do to get all the 60 votes?
Well, quite a few things. In order to win over some other holdouts, Reid's so-called manager's amendment takes out a few things from his original bill, most notably a public option for people buying insurance on these exchanges that are to be set up. In its place, there will be a plan similar to what federal employees have, operated by the Office of Personnel Management and carried out by private insurance firms on a not-for-profit basis. There's also extra Medicaid money for Vermont, which helped lock in the vote of Bernie Sanders, the Senate's only self-declared socialist. Also new is a requirement that no child below the age of 18 can be denied health coverage due to a pre-existing condition starting immediately. For adults, that won't be the case until 2014. And one other change is that they're dropping the proposed tax on voluntary plastic surgery, the so-called Botox, and instead they're going to slap a 10% surcharge on people using indoor tanning parlors.
Indoor tanning parlors. Okay. Is there any chance for support now among Senate Republicans, David?
Well, not one of those Republicans has expressed any intention to vote for the bill, not even Maine moderate Olympia Snowe, who did vote for the Finance Committee's version of the bill. Republicans are saying this revised bill is even worse than what Democrats had earlier proposed, and they're trying to slow down what seems to be inexorable progress towards approval by doing things like demanding today that the entire nearly 400-page manager's amendment be read aloud.
And Democrats say they want this bill finished in the Senate by Christmas. Is that going to happen?
Well, things are on track for that to happen now, but it may take staying in session virtually nonstop until a final vote the Democrats are hoping will happen by Christmas Eve. The big test of their unity comes on Monday at a vote at 1 o'clock in the morning on a procedural matter. That would show whether they really do have the 60 votes that they'll need to get this done. And even if the bill passes, there's yet another big hurdle, reconciling it with the bill passed by the House. But Democrats are still aiming to do all that before President Obama delivers his State of the Union address.
And I suspect you'll be staying up late to watch that vote, David.
Absolutely.
That's NPR's David Wellna from Capitol Hill. David, thanks so much.
You're welcome, Guy.
We're back with All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Guy Raz. And one of the great things about radio is you can't see the ridiculous snow gear I'm wearing, which is not, I should add, an NPR-branded parka, because we don't make them. I'm standing on a street here in downtown Washington, D.C., in the midst of a blizzard of historic proportions. By the end of today, our nation's capital will be blanketed with quite possibly the biggest snowfall since 1922, and it's effectively shut down the city. Now, a day like today sometimes makes you wonder about things like global warming, but this past decade was the hottest on record, and that's one of the reasons why negotiators at the Copenhagen Climate Conference have been so determined to get some kind of international agreement in place. Well, last night, the U.S. and four other countries, Brazil, India, South Africa, and China, finally agreed on a plan to start reducing their carbon emissions. NPR's David Kestenbaum is in Copenhagen, and he reports that this was really a last-minute decision.
When President Obama arrived in Copenhagen, he was visibly frustrated. Usually heads of state like to arrive after a deal has been brokered. Then they can take the stage and make glowing pronouncements. But when the president arrived, a huge rift remained between the United States and fast-growing countries like China. One issue they could not agree on. Many countries had made pledges to reduce greenhouse gas emissions, but the U.S. wanted these pledges in writing as part of the agreement. And President Obama said there had to be a way to know whether countries were living up to those commitments.
Without such accountability, any agreement would be empty words on a page. I don't know how you have an international agreement where we all are not sharing information and ensuring that we are meeting our commitments. That doesn't make sense.
Here's the story of what happened next, according to a senior White House official. On Friday evening here at the Conference Center, White House staff was preparing for one final try. President Obama would meet one-on-one with Chinese Premier Wen Jiabao and separately with a group that included some of the fastest-growing economies, Brazil, India, and South Africa. But Brazil did not want to come if India was not coming, and the Chinese staff were at the airport, apparently ready to leave. It's unclear if this was a negotiating strategy, but the leaders of the five countries eventually sat down and talked, and they began to work out an agreement. With a larger group of countries, they produced a three-page document. How did they resolve that central issue of how to verify countries' pledges? This came down to one sentence in the document. In the hallways here, I ran into Ned Helm, president of the Center for Clean Air Policy, who has followed these negotiations for years.
And this is what they got fixed in the final deal.
So read me the line that took them so long to figure out how to write.
All right. Non-Annex I parties will communicate information on the implementation of their actions through national communications with provisions for international consultations and analysis under clearly defined guidelines that will ensure that national sovereignty is respected. And that whole last part of that sentence, that long phrase, is a key battleground.
The language is a kind of compromise. It doesn't say pledges will be verified. It doesn't use the V word. It says pledges will be, well, that long sentence.
And this creates a consultation process. So you send in your annual report of what you've done, all the plants in the country, how many emissions they've produced, etc. And you say, here, I said my target was minus 45%. How close did I come? Here's my story. And then it's put before a consultative process where you're asked a lot of questions. Well, you know, the cement plants, these don't look like you really did what you said. You said you'd shut down 40 to 45. Did you do it? Show us that.
Are you surprised it took so long to basically write that sentence?
Not really. I mean, part of this, you know, it's language. I mean, we have a big advantage. It's always in English. And for all these other countries, it's tough. You know, I wouldn't want to negotiate. I speak French. I wouldn't want to negotiate a contract in French. And that's what we're dealing with. So there's a lot of stuff here that is very important. And people read where, you know, they don't use words the same way, you know.
Ned Helm says the amazing thing to him here is that the heads of government just sat down and hammered something out.
We were stuck in the mud with the negotiators. They really were stuck in the mud. And we brought in the presidents, and they pulled the truck out of the mud. And that's not normally this kind of deal. The presidents come in and they bless the offering. They couldn't bless the offering. They had to make the offering here. They had to negotiate. I mean, it's amazing that this provision, I'm told, President Obama and Premier Wen Jiabao negotiate themselves, the two of them. You know, can you believe that? That's what I was told. I don't know if that's an apocryphal story, but that's what we were told.
It's clear from these past 2 weeks, the countries of the world are still not so good at this global government thing. But maybe we're getting a little better. David Kestenbaum, NPR News, Copenhagen.